So again, let's start with the short meditation. So finding a nice, comfortable posture. Keeping the back nice and straight. And body completely relaxed, completely at ease. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. Eyes soft and relaxed. Mouth and jaw soft and relaxed. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to regulate or control the breath in any way. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. Letting go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns about the past or the future. Simply allowing the mind to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. We're going to continue with the Tonglen practice, the practice of exchanging self with others, the practice for transforming attachment and aversion into loving kindness and compassion. And again, we can begin by imagining the natural purity of our mind as a small, white, radiant sphere of light in the center of the chest at the level of the heart. This is our Buddha nature, our inner wisdom, the natural purity of our mind that enables us to achieve the highest goals imaginable. And we can begin by expanding our field of loving kindness and compassion out to the person seated next to you. They are just like yourself in wanting to be happy and wanting to be free of suffering. So arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they were free of suffering and its causes. May you be free of all suffering and its causes. And then you can imagine their past, present and future suffering in the form of black smoke filling their body. And then with each in-breath, imagine drawing that black smoke out of their body and bringing it into the sphere of light at your heart, completely dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their suffering at your heart. And then imagine the black cloud is completely extinguished, and now they're completely free of all suffering and its causes. And take joy in this. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they had happiness and its causes. May you be truly well and happy. Then with each out-breath, imagine immeasurable rays of light radiating out from the sphere of light at your heart, completely saturating their body and mind, transforming into everything they need to be happy. So with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, sending them whatever they need to be happy, to find that genuine happiness. And then imagine now that they've found the genuine happiness that they seek, and take joy in this. And then allow your field of loving kindness and compassion to expand out further. And allow your mind to move around. And whoever comes to mind, whether it's a friend, a stranger, or even a difficult person, bring them to mind. May you be free of all suffering and its causes. May you be truly well and happy. And with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their suffering at your heart. And with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, sending them whatever they need to be happy. And allow your mind to continue to move around. And whoever comes to mind, whether it's an individual or even a group of people, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their suffering at your heart, breathing out the light of loving kindness, sending them whatever they need to be happy. no matter how much darkness is drawn into the heart, is all extinguished there without a trace. And no matter how much light is sent out, it is sent out from an inexhaustible source that is in no way depleted. So allow the mind to continue to move around, breathing in with compassion, breathing out the light of loving kindness. Then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply resting in awareness itself. Without trying to do anything at all, just be. Just rest within luminously clear awareness. Not paying any attention to any appearance that arises. Simply resting in pristine, pure awareness. Relaxed and alert. Open and spacious. And maintaining that open, spacious state, we can slowly end the meditation and begin our discussions together today. So again, let's start with a review. So again, we can use the root text at the beginning of your booklet to have a look at the various points we've covered. So this 7-point mind training text, together with the 8 verses of mind training, are probably the 2 most common texts that are used in describing this Lojong system of practice that was widely disseminated in early Tibetan Buddhism around the 11th and 12th century. And here, these 57 slogans are broken up into these 7 points, 7 sections. And we saw that the first one was the presentation of the preliminaries, the basis, meaning the foundation practices that are necessary to have a good foundation for the 2 main practices of wisdom and compassion. And then the second point was the training in the 2 main aspects of practice, the wisdom and compassion. And here, of course, since Lojong system of practice is within the Mahayana tradition, then the wisdom side of the practice is the wisdom of emptiness, and the compassion side is the aspiration of bodhicitta. And again, one of the unique features of the Lojong system of practice is that it uses the exchanging self with others approach in the compassion wing. And this was not so widely taught in ancient India and Tibet. It was sometimes called the secret practice because it was often considered too difficult to implement for the average person. And within that second point then, we looked at both the wisdom and the compassion practice, and within both of those there were instructions on how to do these practices in meditation and then in daily life, the so-called subsequent periods. And within the wisdom practice, we have those 4 statements to come to realize that not only everything we perceive is empty of independent existence, but the perceiver ourselves, the person, the mind as well, is also empty of independent existence, and thereby nothing exists independently. Everything's empty of independent existence. Of course, this does not mean nothing really exists. What it really means is, of course, that everything is a dependent arising, interdependent phenomena. And that by placing our mind on the basis of all this emptiness, by continually meditating on it and holding that experience and deepening that experience, then we will move along the actual path towards enlightenment. And of course, we need to continue to cultivate this wisdom practice in daily life, otherwise we probably won't make much progress, because any little experience we have of emptiness in meditation will be overridden by our continuous grasping at things during our daily life activities. So we need to support that meditation by continuing to cultivate the wisdom practice in daily life. And here, of course, the instruction was to be a conjurer of illusions, meaning not to automatically accept appearances on face value, but to question appearances and to investigate appearances to come to really understand that things are not existing as they appear, that things are like an illusion. And if we do this in daily life, of course, this will reduce our grasping and thereby reduce our mental afflictions and suffering, and that will also, of course, feed back into our emptiness meditation. And then in terms of the conventional awakening mind, the bodhicitta, exchanging self with others, there we saw, of course, the meditative practice was the practice of tonglen, giving and taking. And we saw the instructions of how to do that in meditation. And then there also we need to continue to cultivate this idea of exchanging self with others in daily life. And here we had two pieces of advice. The first was to not allow ourselves to get caught up in reacting to pleasant and unpleasant experiences with attachment and aversion, but rather use those experiences to train further in the exchanging self with others by taking on those very mental afflictions from others and giving them the opposite, the loving kindness and compassion. And so in this way, we can continue to cultivate the exchanging self with others in daily life and not allow our normal instinctive habits, reactive habits and mental afflictions to take hold in our mind. And to support that, it recommended that we train by means of the words, meaning find some short slogans that we can remind ourselves throughout the day of this practice so we don't forget it and get caught up in our old habits. And then the third point we looked at was taking adverse conditions into the path. And here, of course, the goal is to see all conditions as suitable conditions for practice and not just favorable, pleasant conditions. So we can use also the difficult situations in our life that we normally see as problems or obstacles. We can use these difficult situations as fuel for the spiritual path. And we can use these adverse, difficult conditions to help us strengthen both our wisdom and compassion practices. And so here we looked at first the compassion practice, the exchanging self with others. And here the two slogans were to help us to see these difficult situations in a good way, rather than continually blaming others for our suffering and seeing our own self-cherishing mind as our friend bringing his happiness, was to understand that actually it's the exact opposite, that our worst enemy is the self-cherishing mind, even though it masquerades as our best friend, and that actually others, even those who try to harm us, are our friends in terms of benefiting us in our spiritual practice. And so these were the two instructions here, to see self-cherishing as the real enemy and seeing others, sentient beings, as our friends and cherishing them. And there we had some instructions about how to see even the perpetrators of harm as being very kind to us, because they are the ones who really can help us to develop our qualities of patience, compassion, and also they can really see how, they can really test us to see how we are progressing in the spiritual path. And so they are also helpful in this way. And then also, of course, we can use these difficult situations in terms of our wisdom practice. And here, this four lines were a little bit difficult to understand because they were relating the wisdom practice to these four Buddha bodies, which I think for many of us are not so familiar. But it was basically saying that by meditating on illusions as the four Buddha bodies, emptiness is protection unsurpassed. Meaning that by seeing everything in our life, also particularly perpetrators of harm and suffering and so forth, by having these appearances, we can use these appearances as reminders that these things are, in fact, empty of independent existence. They're like an illusion. So we can use all appearances, even these difficult appearances, as reminders or triggers to help us to realize that things are not as they appear and therefore deepen our emptiness practice. And by doing that, of course, then we would not react to these difficult situations with aversion, hostility, and anger. And then also to support these two main practices with difficult adverse conditions was that by seeing adverse conditions, then that would be a reminder to us that harmful, non-virtuous actions will lead to suffering. and virtuous actions will lead to happiness. And so by seeing these difficult situations, that would also then inspire us to engage in virtue and to purify any negative actions we've done. So these were the next section of the how to take adverse conditions into the path, to use them as to inspire us to accumulate virtue and to purify negativity. So we had a couple of, statement there, the fourfold practice is the most excellent method. And then to finish that section, we had one statement, relate whatever you can to meditation right now, meaning that whatever we see in our daily life, then that can be used in the spiritual path to deepen our practice of wisdom and compassion. And so there in the commentary, we saw things like on page 112, that the perpetrator of harm has been my spiritual teacher for training in the awakening mind and the practice of forbearance, and thus has been most kind to me. The moment you see these sufferings in others, right there and then, take them upon yourself. Also, when an intense, unbearable affliction arises because of attachment and anger, contemplate as before and take them upon yourself. After all this, imagine all other beings are free of both suffering and its causes and enjoying happiness. So this is how we can take all situations in our daily life, particularly when someone is trying to harm us, when we see suffering in others, when we see mental afflictions in others, when we see suffering in ourselves or mental afflictions in ourselves, we can take these situations, these difficult situations, as opportunities for developing our compassion and wisdom. But then, at the end of the section, he's quoting Lungri Tampa, the author of the Eight Verses of Mind Training, is saying that basically all of what is called transforming adverse conditions into enlightenment entails the cessation of expectations and apprehensions. So long as these two do not cease, you cannot take adverse conditions onto the path. Meaning, as long as we are caught up in the hope-fear cycle, hoping for pleasant experiences, fearing or worrying about unpleasant experiences, of course we're never going to be able to take adverse conditions into the path. Because we're always going to react to these difficult situations. We'll see them as problems with aversion, hostility, anger, hatred, and we will just compound our suffering. So if we can really see that even these difficult situations are suitable conditions for the spiritual path, then we can overcome this hope-fear cycle, and we can use everything in our daily life as fuel for the spiritual practice and improving our life. And then yesterday afternoon in the last session, we then went on to the fourth of the 7 points. Here, the presentation of a lifetime's practice in summary. Meaning, how can we synthesize all of these Lojong practices into a daily life practice that we can practice our entire life? And here we saw that there are 5 essential ingredients or 5 components of a daily life practice, called the 5 powers. And so let's just briefly review those that we looked at yesterday afternoon, because then what I'd like to do in this session is look at the 5 powers that we can use as we're approaching death, because these same 5 powers can also be very useful for us at the end of our life as we are approaching our own death. They can be very helpful in making sure that it is a good transition through the death process. But first, let's have a look at the 5 powers in terms of our daily life practice.
So the first of the five powers here was the propelling intention. And as we saw in the commentary here, it said that from now on, this is on the bottom of page 112, from now on till my full enlightenment, I shall never be divorced from the two awakening minds, and I shall not allow my mind training to lose its continuity. I shall make sure to never be divorced from the two awakening minds until my death. Bless yourself resolving in terms of this year, this month, and so on. Repeatedly propel your thoughts in this way with great force. So, of course, this is to, the propelling intention is to practice wisdom and compassion throughout the day. So we can, particularly in the beginning of the day, is to set this intention that today I am going to, throughout the day, practice wisdom and compassion. Of course, we can extend that to this week, this month, this year, for the rest of our life, as mentioned here. So this is really to, again, the propelling intention to practice both wisdom and compassion. Then the second power here is the power of acquaintance. And here, of course, it says to cultivate the two awakening minds at all times free of distraction. So then once we've set this propelling intention in the morning, then throughout the day, we can use the power of acquaintance or familiarity, which means to cultivate wisdom and compassion uninterruptedly. And then, of course, to support this practice, the familiarity of wisdom and compassion throughout the day, we have the next two powers, the power of the positive seed. Which here, of course, is mentioned is that during the period in between sessions, to strive in virtuous activities. So here, of course, is to engage in virtue throughout the day, to support the wisdom and compassion. And also to support that, of course, is the fourth power, the power of eradication. Which here was mentioned to the actual eradication of self-grasping. So here then, throughout the day, as much as possible, to let go of self-grasping and of course also self-cherishing. And then the fifth power here is the power of aspirational prayer or dedication, particularly at the end of every virtuous activity, also at the end of every day. And of course here, it is to never be separated from wisdom and compassion throughout our life. And also there we see there was mention of having this aspirational prayer to meet teachers, to help guide us as well. So this is how to, the essence of the Lojong practice is to set the propelling intention at the beginning of virtuous activities, beginning of every day, to practice wisdom and compassion, then to continually familiarize ourselves throughout the day with wisdom and compassion, to support that, then to engage in virtuous activities in general, and then to let go of self-grasping and self-cherishing as much as we can. And then at the end of virtuous activities and end of the day, we can set up this dedication, this aspirational prayer to never be separated the next day, the next week, the rest of our life, never to be separated from wisdom and compassion, and also to aspire to meet qualified teachers to help us in our practice. So these are sort of the core elements of our Lojong practice in daily life. And then we began to look yesterday. Oh, is there any questions about that? Anything's not clear about those 5 points? I think they're fairly straightforward. Okay, let's now go on to where we left off yesterday, and that is that these very same 5 powers can also be very helpful as we're approaching death. So let's see how we can use these same 5 powers at the time of our death, when we're approaching death. And so here then we're over on page 114. And here the 5 powers listed in a slightly different order, and some of them have a slightly different meaning. So let's have a look at what these 5 powers are, how they can help us as we're approaching death. And here we have them in a slightly different order. And the first one here is the positive seed. And here at the time of death, this has a slightly different meaning, because in daily life, positive seed was to engage in virtue in general. So let's have a look here what positive seed means. So we're in the top of page 114. It says, to do this, you offer your belongings to the teachings and the 3 jewels as the gifts of the deceased. It is inappropriate to give these belongings to beings who might be your objects of clinging. Prepare so that even in your aftermath, your possessions do not become conditions for accumulating negative karma. Make excellent offerings to those worthy of veneration. It is not appropriate to offer only tokens of your belongings to those who have been embodiments of kindness. Then without any attachment to your possessions of this life, generate a fearless attitude with regard to your future life. So here we can see that the essence of this is to really let go of attachment. Particularly here, it's mentioning about possessions. So what it's saying is that we really need to, as we're approaching our death, make sure that we've let go of the attachment to possessions by giving away all our things to everyone in an appropriate way. But also, of course, here in terms of let going of attachments, is also we need to let go of attachment to our friends as well. Because any attachment to these things will just create a lot of anxiety and tension as we are approaching death. So let's have a look at that within, again, Alan Wallace's commentary, what he says about this positive seed. And so this is on page 222. The first practice is the power of positive seed. Fear is a big hindrance in the transitional process of dying, so it is very important to die without fear. Fear is useful in life when a truck is about to run you down, but in the face of death, fear is useless because death will run you down no matter what you do. For the Dharma practitioner, death presents the perfect opportunity for meditation, impeded by distraction from the senses and the body. Facing death without fear is not simple. What are you afraid of? If you are afraid of leaving your loved ones, your possessions and body, get used to the idea because it will happen. Everything you are attached to, you will lose. Give up your material goods and all other honors with a sense of fearlessness regarding the hereafter. If you have objects of refuge, bring them to mind and offer everything up, even your body. Just as a car with 200,000 miles may cost more to fix than replace, discard the body and prepare to get a new one. Fearlessly give it all up without reservation. This is what is meant by the power of positive seeds applied to death. So here, it's to give up, let go of attachments to our possessions, so make sure everything's in order, we've given all that away. Let go of attachment to friends, because attachment to friends is just going to create a lot of fear and anxiety. Also here, Alan Wallace mentions to give up attachment to the body, so that because we can let go of attachment to the body, because grasping onto the body also will create a lot of unnecessary fear and anxiety. So this is what the positive seed is about, is to let go of these, all of these attachments, because it's just going to create a lot of fear and anxiety. The second here is the power of aspirational prayer. So let's see what that says. It says, lay out an excellent array of offerings in the presence of the three jewels, request forbearance for your shortcomings, and declare and purify your negative karma. Review as well the pledges you have taken, such as that of going for refuge. Then make offerings to the three jewels, offer torment to Dharma protectors, and make fervent requests to be led to the threshold of the path. Bless me so that in the intermediate state and next life I will remember the two awakening minds and engage in their practice. Help me encounter sublime teachers who reveal this teaching. Lead me to the beginning of a path of happiness. Today I place my hope in you. Then invoke the following aspiration again and again. May I train in the two awakening minds during the intermediate state. May I train in the two awakening minds throughout all lives. May I meet sublime teachers who reveal this teaching. So this is quite similar in terms of the daily life. So in a daily life, the aspirational prayer was to never be separated from wisdom and compassion throughout our life and to meet teachers. We have that here, but this is in terms of the next life. And also at the beginning here, we had the idea of purifying negativities. So this is about being able to let go of negativity so that we can really die without regrets. So let's see then what Alan Wallace says about this aspirational prayer. So that's on page 223. The power of prayer applied to death refers to regret. The longer we live, the more opportunity we have for doing things we regret. Milarepa said that the aim of this practice was to die without regret. The power of prayer entails disclosing all misdeeds and taking refuge. In your mind's eye, make offerings and ask for blessings to sustain the two-body cheaters. Pray to meet spiritual mentors who can guide you on the path that leads to your continuing spiritual maturation, both during the intermediate state and after death, the bardo, and in future lives. So again, here, aspirational prayer initially then is to purify negativities, is to go through these four opponent powers with any negative actions we've done, to be able to then die without regret, and then also to make this prayer to never be separated from wisdom and compassion and meet teachers in our future lives. Then the third here is the power of eradication. So let's see what that is saying here. It says, that which grasps at self and I has made me suffer since beginningless time. This has also brought about my present suffering. So long as I am not divorced from this, no happiness can arise. How have I allowed it to ruin me? This happened because I have assumed a corporeal body, so I shall definitely not assume a corporeal body in the intermediate state. I shall allow my mind to fade into space. Reflecting in this manner repeatedly eradicates self-grasping. So this is the same idea as within daily life, is during the death process, to let go of self-grasping and self-cherishing as much as we can. So let's then also see what Alan Wallace says about this third point. He says, this is recognizing self-grasping as a source of misery. The Buddhist view is that the force of grasping onto one's body perpetuates the cycle of birth, aging, sickness, and death. If by the power of eradication, you release all grasping onto your body and personal identity, you will experience death as liberation. What would it be like to have no body, nothing physical to grasp onto? By the power of habitual attachment to this body, as we disengage from this life, we will experience intense craving for another embodiment. Samsara vulnerability to suffering is perpetuated by grasping. By craving another embodiment, we perpetuate our vulnerability to suffering, our own delusion. The power of eradication during the dying process is identifying the thought, what will happen to me? As grasping onto form, then releasing it completely and letting awareness simply be present in space. Then the next power here is, the fourth is the power of propelling intention. So let's see what that is about. It says, in the past I have enhanced the two awakening minds so that their continuity did not cease. I shall now recall the two awakening minds in the intermediate state and engage in their training. Reflect along these lines and repeatedly recall the two minds. So here, as with daily life then, the propelling intention is to practice wisdom and compassion during the death process. So of course in the daily life, the propelling intention was in the morning to have the intention to practice wisdom and compassion throughout the day. And here, of course, it's the same except throughout the death process. And then, as with daily life, based on this propelling intention, then the next power was the power of acquaintance or familiarity, which means to actually cultivate these two uninterruptedly. So, of course, here is to cultivate wisdom, compassion uninterruptedly throughout the actual death process as we're approaching death. So let's have a look at those two within Alan Wallace's book. So the propelling intention. Here is, he calls it, of course, the power of resolve. The power of resolve applied to death refers to training in the two bodhicittas while in the bardo. Imagine your heart and breath have stopped and you're experiencing awareness similar to a dream. In the dreamlike awareness of the bardo, your body and environment are unstable. The environment is altered just by a thought. Tibetans have many accounts of remembered experiences in the bardo, reporting that many confusing and frightening appearances can arise. For the unprepared, death is very confusing. For several days after bodily death, the unprepared person is not convinced he is dead. After death, an unprepared person takes on a mental form similar to being in a dream and thinks, here I am. In a mental body, the dead person is aware of everyone around him and gets upset that no one responds to him. Finally, the realization of death dawns and the craving arises. I don't want to be dead, I want a body. The power of resolve applied to death is cultivating compassion and insight in the dreamlike state of the bardo, instead of confusion, anger, and craving. Practice the two bodhicittas. While you are dying, resolve. Soon I will be in the bardo and I will cultivate the two bodhicittas. So this is, again, the propelling intention is to practice wisdom and compassion throughout the whole death process and also into the intermediate state, the bardo. Then, of course, on that basis of the propelling intention, then the fifth one, acquaintance, is to cultivate then wisdom and compassion uninterruptedly as we are approaching death. And so here, this is what is mentioned down the bottom of page 114. It says, the power of acquaintance, the key is to first train in uninterruptedly in the in awakening mind. So here, then the instruction how to do that is on the next page, page 115. So it says here, and I think there's another typo error here in the first line. It says, then as you approach the moment of death, lie down on your left. I think that should be right. So lie down on your right side and placing your right hand on your cheek, block the right nostril and with your little finger, and breathe through your left nostril. This is transference in terms of your conduct. Then, preceded by loving kindness, train in the dual practice of giving and taking on the basis of your in and out breaths. So therefore, here then we are practicing the compassion practice, the Tong Len practice. And then it says, while in this state, engage in the practice of ultimate awakening mind thus. So then we switch between this and the emptiness practice. And there it says, contemplating. Everything that shares the nature of samsara and nirvana has its root in the deluded mind.
As for the mind, it never deviates from its primordial nature of Dharmakaya. Reflect how in reality even what is called death has no existence. Combine these two contemplations. So the two contemplations are the ones just mentioned, the Tonglen and the emptiness contemplation. Engage in their practice and die while in that mind state. So we're moving backwards and forwards between the Tonglen practice and the emptiness practice as we're approaching death. And then it goes on to say, if this is unlikely to be feasible, then arouse the true nature of samsara and nirvana that is free of rejection and affirmation within the expanse of the ever-present innate Dharmakaya, which is the uncontrived mind itself. Release your mind restfully in the ultimate expanse and place it upon the mind's ultimate nature, which is devoid of transference. So it's saying here then just basically rest the mind in its ultimate nature. So rest in the emptiness of the mind. Then, even if you are unable to die in tune with the meditative state because of temporarily losing your mindfulness, you will still die with the instructions appropriate for the moment of death. Although numerous celebrated moment of death instructions exist, the master said, nothing is more amazing than this instruction presented here. With this, the complete aspects of the path have been presented without omission. So this is what we are to do here during the death process. Let's have a look at that same instruction from Alan Wallace here and see what he says in terms of how to practice the wisdom and compassion as we are moving through closer to death. So again, this is page 225. He says, the fifth practice while dying is the power of familiarization. Familiarization means maintaining the continuity of the practice of the two bodhicittas through life and through death. If possible, it is generally advised in the Buddhist tradition that one dies while adopting the sleeping lion's posture, lying on the right side with the right palm supporting the right cheek. This posture lines up the subtle channels in the body for facilitating conscious death. Optimally, one dies gradually, without great pain, so that one can apprehend fully each stage of dying. So those are the eight stages I talked about yesterday afternoon. To consciously be aware of each of those stages, to have a conscious death. A sudden death makes it more difficult to pass through this great transition consciously while deepening one's insight into the nature of awareness. It is most important when dying to let go of all of attachments and to face the future without fear. So that's the positive seed, the first point. He's mentioning that again. Grieving loved ones not only cannot help you when you are dying, their lamentations can be very distracting. Politely ask them to leave. If you have a trusted companion, a Dharma friend or spiritual mentor who is not going to be freaking out that you are dying, that person can be helpful. So also it's very important if you're going through the death process to have that conducive environment around you, supportive people and not people freaking out that you're dying. That's not going to be very helpful for you. Likewise, for other people who are going through that transition, if we're around them and freaking out, that's not going to be very helpful because they're going to have a lot of attachment, they're going to have a lot of fear and anxiety. So that's not helpful at all. We need a supportive environment. As you practice a dress rehearsal for death, imagine your final energies are waning. Imagine being lucid during that time, letting go completely everything familiar, releasing everything without a second thought. What is here and now? The two bodhicittas. Cultivate compassion as you die. Imagine that while you still have breath, you practice Tonglen. Imagine taking in the suffering of the world on the in-breath and offering all of your happiness on the out-breath. Move to the practice of ultimate bodhicitta. Releasing, move right into the nature of awareness. If awareness becomes vague, go back to Tonglen.
move back and forth between the practice of ultimate and relative bodhicitta. Practicing the two bodhicittas while dying is dying perfectly. Who dies? The body gets old, stops functioning as a living organism and decays. That is straightforward. But who is the I that dies? Is the sense of I that has been cultivated in life anything more than a fiction based upon this body, this brain, and his personal history? At death, the body no longer supports any kind of ego because the brain shuts down. Personal history ends at death. Unborn awareness, here he's using the term unborn awareness for this clear light mind, the very subtle mind, continues beyond the death of the physical body and the dissolution of the personal ego. Unborn awareness does not die because it was never born. It is unborn during life and it is unceasing after life. If the self-created fictions of I and mine are released before or during the dying process, so this is point three, it is possible to realize the deathless state. No one dies when the fiction of I has been released and the unborn state is realized. So this is talking again about mindfully going through, being conscious of the death process. And when we get to this clear light mind, the unborn awareness, to rest in that with this realization of emptiness. If you are able to rest in the nature of your own awareness, the unborn, as you are dying, spiritual awakening is very close. If you ascertain unborn awareness in life, meaning if we realize emptiness through the clear light mind when we're in meditation during life, you attain the deathless state here and now before physical death. In two lines, Atisha synthesizes the essence of practice for life and death. And that is, apply the five powers, cultivate the two bodhicittas. These are quintessential practices to live for and to die for. Training in dream yoga is excellent preparation for dying. Cultivating the ability to apprehend the dream state during a dream prepares for the state just after death when the bardo is entered. If you are able to recognize the bardo for what it is, you can choose your next rebirth with wisdom, rather than being propelled through simply by the force of your own habituations. However, the bardo, just like dreams, cannot be recognized for what it is without preparation. Without training in apprehending the dream, we mistake everything as real, and habitual responses propel us from one life to the next. The Tibetan Buddhist view of dying as the final opportunity for meditation in this life is counter to the view of most modern scientists and philosophers that consciousness is an emergent property of the brain. The materialistic view that when the brain dies, the consciousness vanishes, and the Buddhist view of continuity of consciousness from one lifetime to another are mutually exclusive. The Buddhist belief is that you, your history, abilities, and intelligence will withdraw into a deeper level of your own awareness at death. Passing through the dying process is similar to passing through a corridor with doors closing on either side. The dying person enters into a blackout state that is like deep unconsciousness and subsequently emerges into the clear light of death, a luminous state in which there is no sense of personal identity. Without personal identity, who emerges in the bardo? You. Your brain will decay, but characteristics and memories emerge following death out of a deep level of consciousness, just as you remember who you are in the morning after awakening from a night of dreaming. Imprints, habitual tendencies, knowledge, conceptualizations, emotions, all the stuff of ego are stored in your mind stream and will manifest in the bardo. Unlike cognitive scientists, Buddhists do not consider the brain to be primary. Consciousness is primary, and it carries on without support or influence by the brain. Therefore, the dying process is very important,
because death is not an end, it is a transition. There we go. I was about to say any questions about this, there probably are, but it's time for a morning tea break. So let's have a morning tea break, and then before we move on to the next topic, we'll see if there's any questions about this or the other five powers during life. But let's do those after the morning tea break.